Well, he is Greek-American. He's a New Yorker.
It's a great American success story.
He's involved in a number of businesses.
He's a great role model.
He's got plenty of ideas on how to bring change.
Enlist the support of business leaders, elected officials.
Katsimatidis rubs shoulders with some of the most powerful people in the world.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
Now that's John Katsimatidis, a native New Yorker.
Mixing common sense thinking with New York sensibility. He's John Katsimatidis, owner of 77 WABC. And this is the Cats Roundtable on Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Everywhere around the world, they're coming to America.
Good morning, New York. This is the New York edition of the Cats Roundtable. We have a great show for you today. We have Steve Moore telling us about the economy. We have Dick Morris. We have a shark attacks in Long Island, possible. And we have an expert on it. And starting right off, Friday night, we talked to Randy Levine, along with Kevin McCullough and Christine Nicholas from the president of the New York Yankees. Let's talk to Randy Levine.
Randy Levine, the president of the New York Yankees, a dear friend, former deputy mayor under the Giuliani administration, just has done so much amazing things for our city. Randy, thank you so much for joining us. And John Katsimatidis, we all know and love, has a radio show also on this station. So, John and Randy, tell us what is going on out in Staten Island.
Yeah, I'll go first because it's in John's hands now. It's in his great hands. Thanks, Chris, and thanks, Kevin. What happened is Major League Baseball and Minor League Baseball agreed to, in effect, change the agreement that went on between the two of them for 100 years. And that agreement used to require 160 minor league teams. And now, because of COVID and because of a whole bunch of conditions that were poor conditions in a lot of these places, the agreement took it down from 160 to 120 minor league teams. And as a result, teams had to reduce the number of minor league affiliates that they had. Major League Baseball took minor league baseball in under its wing. And as a result of that, the New York Penn League, which was a short season league, meaning, you know, single A, lowest level, short season league, would basically go from June through September. It was a lot of players who just drafted, you know, entry-level league was eliminated. It was eliminated. So the Staten Island Yankees, in effect, were eliminated by the agreement between major and minor league baseball. So, you know, the commissioner, Rob Manfred, Hal Steinbrenner, and myself, we felt really bad about that. And baseball, as part of this reorganization, did affiliations with former independent league teams. And those team leagues are throughout the country. The one here on the East Coast is called the Atlantic League. It's a great league. Baseball's used it to experiment with rule changes, video replay, electronic strike zone, changing the distance, you know, from home plate for the pitching mound. Oh, and nice. as a result of that, the idea was to put an Atlantic League team in Staten Island. So we asked, baseball asked, the owners of the Staten Island Yankees, would they like to do it or not? And they turned it down. They said no. So baseball, the commissioner called me and asked me to see if I could put a group together. And the first call I made was to John Katsimatidis because he always steps up on things like this. And John and I had talked about minor league baseball for years. And as he always does, he thought of Staten Island and the community, and he stepped up. Similarly, I knew a great young man named Eric Shuffler, who was a very well-known lobbyist in New Jersey, was very, very interested. And I thought he and John would be a really great combination. He, you know, very hands-on. And they formed a partnership. John's the chairman. Eric, you know, is president. And Yankee Global, the Yankees are going to be involved supporting it. I got the Redbird Capital, which they own the XFL. They're partners in the Red Sox. They're involved, so it's well-capitalized. All really great group of people to make this successful. But I felt it needed a Staten Island taint to it. And I knew Pete Davidson grew up in Staten Island, and Colin Jost grew up in Staten Island, the great Saturday Night Live people. And yeah. I know Michael Che grew up in Brooklyn. So they agreed. They're in the group along with Danny Garcia, who is an incredible businesswoman. She's the ex-wife of The Rock and his business partner and a force on her own. And that's the group. And John has done an incredible job, you know, putting it together. He it's in his and Eric's hands now. We're his partners, and we feel we're in good hands. And that's how it happened, and I'll turn it over
to John. That's pretty exciting. Randy, thank you so much for that insight. John, from your perspective, tell me what your hopes and dreams are for this new Staten Island team.
I've had opportunities to invest in other sports situations, but when I got a call from Randy Levine and an opportunity to be associated with Randy and the Yankees, it took me about 2 seconds to say yes.
It sounds like you're really wanting to be so inculcated into the community. Like, you want this to be a real extension of who Staten Island is and make it Staten Island through and through. And I think that's going to be the glue that holds it together.
Well, Kevin, let me tell you what else we're going to do. We're going to, you know, WABC has Cousin Brucey available, Tony Orlando, Joe Piscopo. A lot of concerts at the stadium.
And oh, that's going to be fun.
And not only that, you know, Radio City Music Hall only has 6,000 seats. Well, we could be bigger than Radio City. We might have an outdoor theater with 7,100
seats.
Wow. I understand the mayor is having a concert at the stadium, August 16th or 17th.
Randy Levine of the New York Yankees, John Catsimatidis, just New York's first person in every way, sense of the word. Thank you, gentlemen, for not just coming on the show, but what you're doing for New York City, what you're doing for Staten Island, and what you're doing for America. God bless you, and God bless your efforts.
What's going on in Long Island? Well, a lot of people are concerned. A lot of people, the beaches may be closed. A lot of sharks may be around. And we have an expert with us. We have Dr. Toby Curtis. He's a fishery management specialist of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. That's NOAA, N-O-A-A, that you all hear about. Good morning, Dr. Curtis. How are you?
All right. Thanks very much for having me, John.
Give us an update. I understand they're closing a lot of beaches because they're scared that a lot of sharks are around all of a sudden in Long Island.
Well, this is actually a phenomenon that happens pretty much every summer. Summertime is shark season off Long Island. This year is actually nothing out of the ordinary. I think there's just been increased media attention when there's sort of high-profile sightings or viral videos and things that go around. But sharks are always found in Long Island waters. They show up every summer, and there's over a dozen species that are actually very common during the summertime off New York. And we've been studying those different shark species for a number of years. So it's really
Sharks increased since the movie Jaws?
In fact, some of them have. Jaws, wonderful work, fantastic movie, wonderful work of fiction, not meant to be an accurate portrayal of sharks, of course. But following Jaws, there's actually a number of conservation measures that went into place for sharks and other fisheries up and down the East Coast. And the white shark population, along with sandbar sharks, black tip sharks, and some other species, the regulations and conservation efforts that have gone in have actually helped some of these shark populations recover in the Atlantic. So part of what we're seeing today.
How many shark incidents are there where bites on an annual basis in Long Island?
Zero, most years. There's been very, very few shark bites in New York ever in history. There were two bites, unfortunate, so minor bites, 2 or 3 years ago on Fire Island. And I think in response to that, I think that's part of the reason why we've seen some increased beach safety efforts by Nassau County, beach safety officials, lifeguards, shark patrols and things. There's some raised awareness following those shark bite incidents, but those are extremely rare. And there's really only about 80 to 100 shark bites worldwide each year. So, you know, millions of people going in the water, but only 80 to 100 shark bites each year. And most of them are minor in nature.
So are you saying that fear is driving the bus more so than reality?
That could be said for sure. The perception of shark danger is kind of overinflated. It's much more dangerous to drive to the beach on Long Island. You know, it's safer I tell people if they want to be safe at the beach to wear their seatbelt on the Long Island Expressway.
The other thing that we've been told, and you'll tell us if it's true or not, that there's rumors that there's a shark nest near Long Island, and that's why the population has increased.
So there, Long Island does have some shark nursery areas. So there's juvenile sharks. The mom sharks sort of come in towards New York waters in spring or early summer, and they actually give birth to pups. So white sharks have a nursery area off eastern Long Island. There's sand tiger sharks have a nursery. We've actually been catching a number of juvenile dusky sharks and mako sharks. So there's a number of species that are common in New York, but near shore waters off Long Island is actually home to baby sharks from a number of species.
Dr. Toby Curtis, thank you for everything you do, and God bless you, and God bless all the sharks in the world.
Thanks very much, John. Take care.
What's going on with COVID in New York? Well, one of the experts we have today is Dr. Ramon Talaj, and he's with Summers Community Care, and he opened up all the big accesses to COVID vaccines in New York City, and he knows his stuff. Good morning, doctor. How are you this morning?
Good morning, sir. I'm more than glad to be with you in your program. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Tell me all the centers you opened up for the COVID vaccines.
Well, the reality, we have opened probably 150 NYCHA places, around 10 mega sites, like Arco de Racetrack, the Yankee Stadium, most of the schools, the Taft School, you know, the Brandeis, or Hot Point. All of these places we opened, besides churches and more than that, all our 600 doctors' practices in New York doing vaccination to our patients in the Medicaid-based community.
All of a sudden, we have a possible new crisis, and it's Delta variant. How do you view it, and are people going to need additional boosters? Give us your opinion.
I would take a moment to explain to you that when you get a vaccine, what you get with the vaccine is that you have the right away, a way to produce antibody called IgG. Then people who got the vaccine will be able to defend themselves faster, because the person without the vaccine had to pass through the whole process, fever, chills, all the complications, even die. People need to understand that. When you have the vaccine, you have more chance, first, to avoid the first process, and second, to have the right antibody, the one who killed the virus. Certainly, this new variant has changed herself. Put it this way. You have a car who's been hit for three different places. Those are three variants. Now you have a new variant. In those places, this car changed the outside to try to avoid you to kill it with antibody. This variant is new, the Delta. It's another place that it changed. But still, most of the vaccine have places where they hit and destroy the virus, not as effective than from the beginning. But this is why it's so important. You get the vaccine, that doesn't preclude you to not to find the virus. You still could get the virus. We saw that with the Yankee players. The important is, how do you want the vaccine to fight you? Without the vaccine, the virus, I'm sorry. Without the vaccine or with the vaccine? Certainly, vaccinated is the way. If the virus gets you at any moment, you will be able to defend yourself better than if you don't have the vaccine.
How many people in New York City have, and how many people have not the vaccine? And you recommend they get it right away, because that's going to better protect them.
There's no question that in our case, we already passed the million doses in New York City. We feel very proud. From the beginning, you know, we didn't wait. We established the places. We jumped in. We opened those places with our own resources. You know, we discussed later on how to get the country reimbursed. But we opened it because we knew that was the right answer to this virus. And right now, according to the governor's office, it's more than 75%. But that means that 2.5 million or more of people has not get the vaccine. They still could get the virus. And that's the problem, because the virus could change again. This is Delta. If something has come, the vaccine will be even less effective. Yes, most likely we will need a new vaccine that will be one who destroy these variants, whichever they are. And I know that those companies are already working on that.
Thank you, Dr. Ramon Talaj, thank you for all the lives you save in New York. Thank you, doctor, and God bless you and God bless New York. Thank you so much.
Always your thing. Thank you, sir.
You're a great American. You're a classic example of the people who built this country.
He's got plenty of ideas on how to bring change.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
This is the Cats Roundtable on Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's John Catsimatidis.
Good morning, America. This is the Cats Roundtable. John Catsimatidis here. Sunday morning. The economy. What's going on? Well, with us is one of our top five economists in the country, Stephen Moore. How are you, Stephen?
Hey, I'm doing very well, John. Thank you.
Tell us, the stock market is a roller coaster. It's up 500, right. Down 500, up 300.
Right.
Which way are we going?
Well, I think one of the really two interesting things happened this past week, John, that need to be commented on if folks want to understand what's going on with the economy. Number one, we got the GDP report that came out for the second quarter that ended in July. And what that report shows is that the economy grew at a pretty nice pace, 6 to 6.5%, which is good, although coming out of a deep recession like we are, it's not a great number. But it also fell considerably under the expectations of what we thought. We were hoping we'd get 8 to 10% growth. And then the question is, why? Why are we falling short of expectations? Is this recovery running out of steam? And there are some indications that it is. I do believe, by the way, if Donald Trump were still president, we would have had 10% growth for the second quarter. But it's almost like the Biden administration is putting ankle chains on the economy with all this spending and debt and this promise of higher taxes. And then all related to that is the second issue, which is the inflation number continues to be bad. And it's not getting better. It's getting worse. We got another bad consumer inflation report out on Friday. And I believe what's going on is the Fed even acknowledged, the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said in his testimony to Congress, he said, we're surprised that inflation has been high, and he expects inflation to be high for a number of months to come. Well, that's quite an admission by the Fed Reserve Board, and that doesn't inspire a lot of confidence in investors when he says, we don't know if we have control of this inflation problem. It's like driving on a bus and the driver saying, I don't know if I can steer this thing. And so I think that's caused a little bit of consternation among investors. If we get more inflation, then that's going to be a problem for the economy because consumers are really feeling it now. And one last point, John, I believe that the worst thing we can do if we're trying to solve the inflation problem, the absolute worst thing we could do is to spend another $4 trillion and borrow $4 trillion and ultimately print $4 trillion because that's going to make inflation worse, not better.
Now, interest rates, the Federal Reserve met. And they said they're going to hold them down. Do they realize that inflation is going up faster than they can hold them down?
I don't think they do. I think it's a great point, a great question, John. And, I was nominated by Trump to be on the Federal Reserve Board. I didn't make it. But I can guarantee you, if I were over there right now, maybe this is the reason they didn't want me on the Federal Reserve Board.
You deserve to be in the Federal Reserve Board. Everybody goes through divorces, and they blamed your divorce. The heck with divorces,
Well, thank you, John. But my point is that I would be raising holy hell if I were over there. I'd be saying, come on. We've had the zero interest rate policy now for many, many years. The Fed continues to buy assets like these mortgage-backed securities, and I think they are building up a little bit of a bubble right now. So I think the precautionary principle says the Fed should, and I think they say they're not going to even start raising rates till late 2022 or 23. I think that's too long. I think it's too accommodative. And the problem is once inflation gets out of control, John, it's hard to stuff that genie back in the bottle, and I think Jerome Powell may learn that lesson the hard way.
What else would you like to tell the American people on this beautiful summer weekend?
Well, I'm angry at some of these Republicans. The other big story of the week was the Republicans joined hands with the Democrats to approve at least the first stage of this $1.2 trillion spending bill. I don't understand the logic of it. I think it was a political and policy blunder by these 16 or 17 Republicans in the Senate. We should be cutting our government spending now, not raising spending. And I don't understand the logic of this. And I think the Wall Street Journal put it very well, that they're playing right into the hands of Joe Biden. And if they agree to this $1.2 trillion so-called infrastructure bill, which is mostly green energy projects and other things that we don't need to be spending money on, then this greases the skids for a $3.5 trillion, one of the, you know, the massive gargantuan Godzilla-style spending and tax bill that the Democrats want to pass without the Republicans. So I think the Republicans made a big blunder. I hope that Mitch McConnell is able to bring Republicans back into the fold and say, no, we're not agreeing to another massive $1 trillion bill. By the way, John, you might have seen the report. The General Accounting Office, the GAO, the auditors of the federal government said there's $1 trillion they haven't spent from the last bill. Why do we have to spend another $1 trillion if they've got $1 trillion sloshing around that we haven't already spent?
Stephen Moore, thank you so much for everything you do and tell the people, the American people, the truth. And we'll catch up with you again real soon. And
all right, John, have a great weekend.
I'll listen to More Money on WABCRadio.com every Saturday afternoon
between
2 p.m. God bless. Okay,
thanks again.
Well, with us today is Dick Morris, who was a chief advisor to President Bill Clinton, a chief advisor to President Donald Trump, Democrats, Republicans. We don't care. We just want to know what the heck is going on. Dick Morris, give us an update. What's going on?
Okay. Well, Biden is dropping precipitously in his ratings. Last Sunday, we talked about it, and I told you that I thought there was a move in the country from optimism to pessimism, and that the number of people that were optimistic about the future of the country was down by 20% in 8 weeks, and the percent that were pessimistic was up by 20%. Now the other shoe is dropping, which is that it's becoming very clear that Biden's ratings are in serious trouble. According to Gallup, between May and July, he dropped 6 points in approval from 56 to 50. And that, of course, is strategic turf in a presidential race that was basically 50-50. And the question is, why? Why did it drop? Now, some people say, particularly conservatives and Republicans, that it's the trifecta of issues that Biden is in terrible shape on. The economy, where he's down by 8 points. The crime and law and order, where he's down by more than 8 points, and I'm not sure the exact number. Immigration, inflation, and crime are the big three. And his ratings on all three are terrible. But I believe it's something else. I believe that it's COVID. I think that he was elected as a single-issue candidate on COVID. His big campaign promise was that he was going to solve the problem, return things to normal, and end the crisis. And he was very vague about how he'd do it, but he said he had a plan, and he said he would follow the science, and that Trump won't do that. And he really scored big points with that. And when you look at the exit polls in the election, those people who were most concerned about COVID voted for Biden. Those who were somewhat less concerned about it voted for Trump. And that pattern held true throughout the entire election. But now COVID is back, and back in a form that is probably more easily transmittable and scares the hell out of people. And it's a transparent failure of the Biden presidency. Number one, he couldn't get people in vaccinated fast enough or get enough people to agree to it. So the population is a quarter of the population is not immune. Secondly, he's toying with measures like closing down schools, closing down businesses, and requiring masks again, even among people who are vaccinated. Now, why should I, who got the shot, have to not send my child to school or close down my business or wear a mask all the time when I've gotten two shots? And the answer is my neighbor didn't get any shots. He stayed home, and I have to wear a mask and close my business and keep my kid out of school to protect him. And that's not going down very well with people.
That's very concerning.
Yeah, I think he who lives by the sword dies by the sword. And Biden has lived by the issue of COVID. And now it's transparently rising against him. I think the other thing is that the draconian measures that were adopted to try to limit the spread of the virus, particularly in the New York area, were effective then, and most of us put up with them. We were told to close our businesses, and we did. We were told to close the schools, and we locked the door, and we put the stupid masks on. But now, when we're facing a revival of COVID, and we've had shots, and everybody agrees that this COVID, while it spreads more easily, is also less dangerous and less lethal, the left wants to reimpose these mandates. They want to close the schools and close the businesses again. And most of us don't see the reason for that. And the naked desire for power that had been clothed and covered up in the garments of caution and protecting the spread of the disease now is on full display.
Yeah, I heard that there's 160 million people have been vaccinated. And the fact is that only something like a couple of thousand have died from COVID, which those people might have died anyway.
Yeah, under 1,000 of COVID deaths in the recent, I think it's 313. It was 313 yesterday, and it's basically been about 100, 150, and minimal percentages. And the reactions are extreme. Pelosi, for example, threatened to arrest staff and visitors to the U.S. Capitol who were not masked, even if they had been immunized, vaccinated. And one congressman who was protesting that pointed out that the total number of COVID patients in D.C. area hospitals was all of 27 people. And even the people who are hospitalized are far less likely to die. So the ratio of risk for having the flu or having the virus are pretty similar.
Dick Morris, I'm going to be listening to your radio show on WABC Radio today at 12 o'clock on Sunday, 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock. Thank you for being with us for the Cats Roundtable Local Edition, the number one show on Sunday mornings in New York. Keep listening to us for the Cats Roundtable National Edition between 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock. So we'll be back to you in a few minutes after the news.
Well, he is Greek-American. He's a New Yorker.
It's a great American success story.
He's involved in a number of businesses.
He's a great role model.
He's got plenty of ideas on how to bring change.
Enlist the support of business leaders, elected officials.
Katsimatidis rubs shoulders with some of the most powerful people in the world.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
Now that's John Katsimatidis, a native New Yorker.
Mixing common sense thinking with New York sensibility. He's John Katsimatidis, owner of 77 WABC. And this is the Cats Roundtable on Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Everywhere around the world, they come to America.
Good morning, America. This is the Cats Roundtable National Edition, and we have a great show for you today. We have Scott Pruitt, from the former EPA administrator. What's going on since the new president has taken office 6.5 months ago? Then we have Gordon Chang talking about what's going on in China. We have Larry Kudlow about the economy. Bill O'Reilly will comment on Sunday morning. And without further ado, we have General Petraeus, an exclusive. What's happening in Afghanistan? He served our country for 37 years in the Army. He was commander of Central Command and commander of Allied forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he was director of the CIA. What more knowledgeable person than that can we ask to find out what's really going on? General Petraeus, good morning. How are you?
Doing great, John. Great to be with you.
There's been rumors that things are not going so well over there in Afghanistan. And a lot of Americans say that maybe we shouldn't have left some people there. Give us your opinion.
Well, I have noted since the announcement of the decision to withdraw that I feared that we would come to regret the decision to withdraw our forces. I didn't sense that we would realize this quite as quickly as it seems is the case. Keep in mind that when we withdrew our 3,500 forces, that all of our NATO and non-NATO coalition partners felt that they had to withdraw their 8,500 troops. and also over 15,000 contractors left. And that latter category is hugely important because it is what has kept the Afghan Air Force, which flies U.S. provided fixed and rotary wing aircraft for both transport and close air support, and many of the vehicles that we've provided and other weapon systems, keeps them all operational. And it's very clear that the challenges of maintaining those systems are even more than I think folks thought they might be. Also, the Afghans are expending munitions at a much greater rate since, of course, our close air support and intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets aren't present to help them. They're under enormous pressure. The security situation has deteriorated. The Taliban has quite swiftly taken control of a good number of the districts in Afghanistan. There's fighting on the outskirts, even of major cities like Kandahar, where, to its credit, the U.S. did use close air support to support our Afghan partners. But clearly, the situation is very concerning because the ultimate outcome could be the reimposition of an ultra-conservative, Islamist, medieval, theocratic regime, which we saw before when the Taliban controlled much of the country, including the area in which al-Qaeda was allowed to establish the sanctuary in which the 9/11 attacks were planned. And of course, there is a real potential of a civil war between the Taliban and their insurgent and extremist partners, government forces, and various warlord militias of different ethnic and sectarian groupings that could be very, very damaging, loss of life, loss of infrastructure, millions of refugees flooding into neighboring countries, Pakistan in particular, which still has millions of refugees from the civil war that followed the collapse of the post-Soviet government in Afghanistan in the 1990s. So again, a lot about which to be concerned, but certainly some options that are there if we choose to exercise them to help our Afghan partners, to help them stabilize the security situation, which has been deteriorating so alarmingly in the past 2 months, and indeed to stave off what could be a very brutal civil war.
Are you confident that Afghanistan is going to get the supplies they need from us to maintain control over the Taliban?
Clearly, the administration has to explore the options that are available. I have enormous confidence in the national security team that the president has established, very, very bright, capable, experienced individuals. I'm confident that they are keenly aware of the challenges that are accumulating in Afghanistan, and will put in front of the president and those underneath him, the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, the options that are available to help our Afghan partners to ensure they don't literally run out of ammunition, to ensure that they can maintain the critical air assets. Because, again, keep in mind that if the police and soldiers out on these far-flung outposts in a country that has the Hindu Kush Mountains as its spine and very limited road infrastructure that is secure, if those individuals don't think that there's anyone coming to the rescue with additional troops, with aerial medevac assets, if they're wounded and with close air support and additional ammunition and so forth, if they think that's going to be the case, it's doubtful that they're going to fight. And we have seen instances where police in particular on these outposts have essentially deserted, thrown down their weapons, surrendered, what have you. Military fighting is still pretty hard, and the special operations forces showing real determination, capability, and expertise. But there's 30,000 of them, and they're trying to be rushed all over the country with the Afghan air assets and various ground systems. Again, if those are not functioning or can't be maintained operationally ready, then you're going to see the downward spiral potentially escalate.
The other concern was that the Taliban delegation was in China for meetings. Anything to concern us there?
Well, again, I don't think it's in our interest or, frankly, the interest of the Western world, even the interest of China, frankly, that again, an ultra-conservative Islamist emirate be established in Afghanistan. China has a very small border with Afghanistan. It's a little corridor at the end of a corridor of land that juts out to the northeast of Afghanistan. It's literally snowed in many months of the year, but they don't want to see Islamist extremists coming into their country from Afghanistan. Now, what they're trying to do is establish a relationship with the Taliban in case it's useful later on. I think, understandably, they, like us and other countries, would love to be able to take advantage of the extraordinary mineral resources in the ground in Afghanistan. We estimated, when I was the commander in Afghanistan and at the agency, that this was more than $2 trillion worth. Huge lithium deposits, rare earths, copper, other minerals, and some energy resources as well. And again, I'm sure that they would love to extend the Belt and Road Initiative into Afghanistan if the security situation permits. They have tried in the past to mine copper there. They owned a copper mine or had access to a copper mine south of Kabul. But after being on the receiving end of some rocket attacks, they decided that they would postpone that and perhaps pursue that in another day. So again, I think this is somewhat understandable. Again, all of the countries around Afghanistan are going to hedge bets. They're going to try to mitigate risks. All of them have concerns about what can happen if the Taliban are allowed to rule Afghanistan or the bulk of Afghanistan again. And more importantly, what happens prior to that? Again, is there the kind of full-blown civil war that we saw in the 1990s? Are there millions of refugees that flood into neighboring countries? Is extremism allowed to establish sanctuary in Afghanistan? Keep in mind that, by the way, it's not just Al-Qaeda that is trying to reestablish sanctuaries in Afghanistan. It's also the Islamic State Khorasan Group, an affiliate of the Islamic State that, of course, established the caliphate in Iraq and northeastern Syria, which we had to respond to back then. And I think one of the lessons, John, if we can step out a bit, I think one of the lessons of the past 20 years of war with Islamist extremists is that you have to keep an eye on them. You have to keep pressure on them. You have to have situational awareness so that if they are trying to reconstitute themselves after being defeated or even destroyed, as we did to Al-Qaeda in Iraq during the surge and the subsequent 3.5 years before we withdrew, that if they're allowed to reconstitute, and in that case, they reconstituted as the Islamic State, that they can cause a great deal of damage, and we may have to actually go back into a country. So the lesson I've taken is that a sustained, sustainable presence is probably the best course, with a lot of drones and close air support available, so that you can help both your host nation partners, as we did with the Iraqi security forces and the Syrian Democratic Forces. They did the fighting on the ground, on the front lines. We enabled them to defeat the Islamic State and to end its caliphate. I hope that that is not what we have to do in Afghanistan down the road, but the trends are quite concerning at present.
So, General, I hear concerning your voice and this concern in many Americans' voice. What the heck do we do?
Well, again, there's a number of options that I'm sure members of the administration and others and those in Kabul are examining. Various actions that can be taken to ensure that the Afghan Air Force stays operational, that Afghan forces don't run out of air or ground munitions, that the weapon systems, vehicles, and all rest of that are supported with maintenance, spare parts, mechanics that can ensure their readiness, close air support, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance assets, drones in particular, all the rest of that, all of which will be much more difficult, needless to say, it already is, because, of course, we have handed off to the Afghans the two major bases that we used to use in Afghanistan, Kandahar and Bagram. In any event, there's lots of options. There are a lot of activities that we can take. Some of these will be difficult to decide upon because they would seem to indicate, again, a bit of a reversal of what the policy decisions have been. I'm confident that they will recognize the situation for what it is and, at the very least, provide the options to the president for his consideration as we seek to support or continue our support for our Afghan partners and allies.
General Petraeus, thank you so much for everything you've done for our country and continue to do for your country. And God bless you and God bless America.
It was a great privilege, John, and always good to be with you. Thank you.
This is the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back.
Telling it like it is, giving you both sides of the story with common sense thinking. It's the Cats Roundtable.
Good morning, America. This is the Cats Roundtable, John Katzman. It's here Sunday morning. What's going on in America in energy? My God, it's been now almost six months since President Biden has taken over. There's been vast changes for the good or for the bad. And with us today is Scott Pruitt. Scott Pruitt was served as Attorney General of Oklahoma. And then in President Trump's administration, he served as Administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency and knows the energy business real well. Good morning, Scott Pruitt. How are you?
John, good morning to you. How are you doing today?
I am doing good. I just want to make sure the American people are doing good. Since you left office at the EPA, gasoline has gone from $2 a gallon to $3.50 a gallon.
Yeah, John, and I'll tell you, I mean, the last administration did all that we could to make us more independent, you know, to make us not reliant upon Europe and the Mideast with respect to how we do energy in this country, and now we're becoming more dependent. And so it's always a different view, you know, with Democrat administrations versus Republican administrations. Republicans believe that energy is a gift to this country and we should take advantage of it and use it, obviously with good stewardship in mind. But we should do so for the American people with more jobs and lower energy costs and resiliency as far as the power grid. All those things are at risk right now. We see blackouts in Texas in February during winter months. We see, you know, even calls during the summer with the temperature rising of the same type with the power grid. We see higher gas prices and, again, more dependence upon what's going on with OPEC and Europe. And so it's really disappointing to see in such a short time that this particular administration has done more to unravel and change direction with respect to Americans having control over their own destiny with respect to energy and as opposed to them being more dependent upon people they don't know and they can't see and they can't touch.
Well, under President Trump's administration, we had 14 million barrels a day in production. I think we're down to 12 now. I'm not sure. Something like that.
And again, it's not because, I mean, John, what was so exciting during the last 4 years was you saw independent, you know, gas producers and folks in the energy sector generally that were, you know, growing and expanding and hiring people and providing low energy costs, both for electricity as well as, you know, gasoline. And now you see the opposite of that. And so, I mean, it shouldn't be surprising, you know, to anyone at this juncture. And I think in times, you know, we think that things might be different and maybe they'll do things much more, you know, reasonable or whatnot. And that's just not the case. I mean, this administration, you know, you can't be for big government, you know, big taxes and big bureaucracy and be for the little guy. And that's exactly what this administration is. They're for big government, they're for big taxes, and they're for big bureaucracy. And you can't go out and trump that and advance that at the same time as saying you're for the little guy.
And we did lose the pipeline, and I still don't understand how the President Biden authorized the Russian pipeline. I mean, if President Trump would have authorized the Russian pipeline, I guess they would have hung him for treason.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, it's this approach that's so inconsistent, so hypocritical, you know, of saying no at home, you know, to the American people and saying yes to those people that don't even, you know, that you don't serve, that aren't American people. And for the betterment of Europe, the answer was yes. And for the worse for Americans, the answer was no. And so it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It creates instability. It creates uncertainty. It creates higher gas prices. And it's just hypocritical and inconsistent.
The other concern I have, the administration is pushing electric cars. And electric cars are run by batteries that are 90% made by China. And then most of those precious metals that make those batteries are in Afghanistan, and we just left Afghanistan, and China may take over the whole thing.
Yeah, John, I mean, I think that, look, I mean, with all the marketing, with all the tax incentives, with all the government subsidies that we've seen put, you know, behind electric vehicles over, you know, multiple years and multiple administrations, candidly, it still only represents, you know, less than 3% of the entire market as it relates to, you know, consumers. And consumers have spoken loud and clear. You know, they believe that electric vehicles should be, an option, you know, that they should obviously complement and supplement the choices that consumers and Americans have as far as driving and use of a vehicle. But to try to abandon, the auto industry abandoning, you know, SUVs and vehicles that have driven, you know, the economy in this country, both from a manufacturing perspective, but also a dealer perspective and the consumer demand and choice, to think that that's somehow just going to magically change in the next 5 or so years and everybody's going to be driving an electrical vehicle when the infrastructure is not even there. And there are limitations, as you know, John, physics, laws of physics limitations that will forever impact people's ability to transport themselves from coast to coast if they want to drive a car across the country. And so it's just not, you know, in my view, you know, you continue to see this advancement by government to force, you know, consumers to adopt that which they believe. It's paternalistic. I mean, it's not allowing the market and the economy to drive what should occur. It's government telling consumers what they can and cannot choose and what they can and cannot consume. And the same is true in the energy sector with respect to the power grid. I mean, we're getting to country where you're going to have utility companies that are going to come in and monitoring as far as use and determine that your thermostat should be set at a certain degree at certain times during the day. It's already happening in these areas of the country where there are challenges as far as providing consistent electricity. Because as you know, John, I mean, before this administration, before the Obama administration, oil, natural gas, and coal represented over 80% of how we generate electricity on the power grid. And today that is, you know, that's probably in the 50 to 60 range. And so we continue to see, you know, a reduction of resiliency and reliability. Those baseload fuels that have always been there to ensure that we have access to power when we need it. And we're replacing it with intermittent power, wind and solar, that when the sun's not shining, the wind's not blowing, we can't store that power. And as such, that power grid is what? Vulnerable. And it prevents us from having the reliability to grow an economy, to produce steel, to manufacture and to heat and cool our homes. And so all these things have consequences. And this administration is telling the American people, again, we're about big government. We're about big bureaucracy. We're about big taxes. And we're about all those things. And I just don't believe, John, that if you're for all those things, that you can be for that small business employer, you know, that you know. This whole tax code that's being produced, you know, 4,000 or less, you know, no tax increases. Well, how many small businesses, John, do you know out there that are in New York City or across this country that are working hard to make $500,000 a year? And what's going to happen to those folks? They're going to get taxed at the same rate that Exxon's getting taxed at. You know, so it makes no sense whatsoever.
Now, in addition, the high energy prices is hurting the consumer. I mean, like we said before, gasoline has gone from $2 to $3.5 a gallon, and it's leading to higher food prices, higher inflation, higher everything, because everything is transportation.
And then when you combine that, John, with the spending, I mean, a $1.3 trillion infrastructure package, a proposed spending on the back end, as you know, the White House, along with certain individuals in Congress are voting, emphasizing the package of what, $3 to $5 trillion on top of that. That's on top of the pandemic spending in the trillions of dollars. I mean, there are consequences to these things, and you can't just simply spend in a profligate way, and think that you can tax to take advantage of it, because it's going to slow and kill the economy in that regard. And so the growth that we've seen, I mean, with respect to the economy, largely has been based upon what? This injection of liquidity into the markets. But that can't just continue ad infinitum. At some point, you've got to have real jobs created by real businesses and consumers, and the consumer mentality driving that. With high inflation, that's going to be a problem.
Scott Pruitt, thank you for everything you've done for America. Continue to work towards America. And let's catch up again real soon.
Thanks, John. Have a good one.
This is the Catch Roundtable. We'll be right back.
Here's the man who is New York, exploring the truth, telling both sides with common sense thinking. Here's John Catsimatidis on Talk Radio 77 WABC. This is the Cats Roundtable.
Going on in the other side of the planet, China, Afghanistan, Japan. Well, with us today is one of our experts. It's Gordon Chi Chang, and his Twitter handle. Never forget his Twitter handle. You'll find out up to the minute what he is, at Gordon G. Chang. Good morning, Gordon. How are you?
I'm fine, John, and thank you so much.
Tell us, give all Americans an update. What the heck is going on? I mean, we hear a lot of rumors.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. For one thing, the Delta variant is hitting China very hard right now. They have Nanjing, which is a city of about 9.3 million, has, they say, 200 cases, but probably a lot more. State media says that Nanjing has been hit harder than any city since Wuhan. That's going back, of course, to 2019. But with this most recent string of cases, it's spread to 5 provinces, 13 cities, including Beijing, and it's not over yet. So China right now is in going through another wave of disease. You know, at the same time, there's so many other things that are occurring. It's just almost impossible to keep up with what's happening there.
I thought China has it pretty much under control, of things going on there. They've lost control on the... virus?
I don't think they ever really had it under control. I mean, that was what they told the world. And at times, I think that they were winning the battle. But we've seen, for instance, if we go back about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, they were shutting down their crucial ports in Guangdong province, which is the southern part of China, where their big ports are. And those have been shuttered because of what they say were 3 cases, but obviously a lot more. So there have been times when China has sort of been on top of this, as you point out, but not right now.
The other rumor I have, is I think it's verified, that with all the problems going on in Afghanistan, we understand that the Taliban went to visit with the Chinese government. What have you heard?
Yeah. Representatives of the Taliban met with Wang Yi, the foreign minister, who's the number 2 diplomat in China. And Beijing right now sees both opportunity, but I think more sees danger in what is happening in Afghanistan, which shares a 47-mile border with China. As the U.S. leaves, there's a vacuum. The Taliban will fill it. But the thing about the Taliban is that although it is the major element there, and although China's had very good relationship with the Taliban, even after 9/11, the Taliban has enemies. And those enemies are going to become the enemies of China. And also India, which is influential in Afghanistan, is also now got an incentive to give China a hard time. As a matter of fact, India already did that this year. An Indian tip actually broke up a espionage ring of including China and the Haqqani network. So India has a lot of incentive to go after China, and they'll see China's relationship with Kabul as being basically one of China's weak points.
Hong Kong. I understand that some of the business people, who was sentenced for 9 years now, a protester?
Yeah, the first case. The first person who was charged under the national security law, which Beijing imposed June 30 of last year, was sentenced for 9 years, which is considered a very stiff sentence, considering that basically he was advocating independence, and also he was accused of dangerous driving. There are maybe another 100 or so, probably a bit more than that, people who have been charged under the NSL, and they are coming up for trial. The biggest trial was that of Jimmy Lai, entrepreneur, the owner of Apple Daily, which was not only Hong Kong's main pro-democracy newspaper, but was Hong Kong's main newspaper. Jimmy is mid-70s, I think 75. He's probably going to spend the rest of his life in jail, in a Chinese jail, unless the United States does something to free him, which we should absolutely do.
Why some of the left-wing American people say communism is a better way of life? Have you figured that out yet, Gordon?
I have no answer to that, because we have seen not only what's occurred in the five established communist countries, but also what was occurred recently on the streets of Havana and 40 other cities and towns in Cuba. It just doesn't work. I mean, people may say they like the idea of communism, of socialism, but they forget that the only way to implement it is to for the regime to use force, because communism goes against life. It goes against human instincts. And as much as we'd like to think that people are perfectible, no, they're not. And so communism has never worked, and what we have seen are genocides and mass killings wherever communism has been put in place.
Taiwan, should we start fearing that something may happen in Taiwan? Will they be challenging us in the near future, you think? I mean, a lot of our chips come from Taiwan for our computers.
Yes, well, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company is the world's leader producer of sophisticated chips. I mean, Americans designed the most sophisticated computer chips in the world, but we can't make any of them. They're made by TSMC. And many people actually say, and this is subject to some dispute, but some people say that China will invade Taiwan because it wants TSMC. Other people say, well, no, they won't invade Taiwan because they need TSMC chips. I actually think, you know, probably there's a real risk of invasion. There are a lot of reasons, of course, for China not to invade, but the one thing that we don't think about are the problems in the Chinese Communist Party in senior circles that gives Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, a very low threshold of risk. So he could do something which is we consider irrational, something that we think is impossible, but he has incentives to do it because we, at this point, don't really understand what's going on there, but we can see the symptoms of severe stress.
We've got a minute left. What else do you have for the American people on a Sunday morning?
The way that China treated Wendy Sherman, the Deputy Secretary of State, on Monday in Tianjin was disgraceful. And it really shows that as much as the United States wants to talk to China, China is in no mood to talk to the U.S. That's signs of problems in Beijing, but it's also signs that we should stop our efforts to pursue the Chinese, because they're just not in a mood, or they're not capable to have meaningful discussions with us.
There was rumors around that when Hunter Biden was in China, he refused to have the Secret Service around with him. Is there anything to that, or is that just a lot of BS?
I don't know, but the one thing we have to be concerned about Hunter Biden in China is that we know he's a troubled individual. If he actually did something, I'm sure that China's Ministry of State Security has video and audio recordings, and they could be used as blackmail. And we might never know about it, because this will be a private conversation between some Chinese diplomat and President Biden. A father will protect his son. We've got to be concerned there are national security implications here.
Wow. Gordon G. Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, thank you so much for coming on and keeping track of what's really going on. And we'll catch up again real soon.
Thank you so much, John.
We have Larry Kudlow on the line. I mean, does Larry even need an introduction? Who doesn't know who Larry Kudlow is? He's our financial guru. Absolutely.
Larry,
hi, everybody.
How is the roller coaster of the markets treating us?
Well, look, markets were down today. They were down a bit this week, but they're still holding the high ground. You're still, you know, they lost a little bit after hitting 35,000 on the Dow, but there's a lot of powerful numbers today. We're now through above the pre-pandemic levels of the whole economy. GDP is strong. Workers are getting paid. Worker wages rising 3.5% year on year. So they're coming back very nicely with good productivity, 2.6%. Profits are roaring. Inflation is too high, 4% year on year, although it's not the worst thing I've ever seen. and there may be a let up in inflation coming. Just today, Chicago purchasing managers were very strong, way above expectations. I mean, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. We got the infrastructure bill. I could do without all the green stuff, which inflated the cost to taxpayers. And the big thing is going to be this budget reconciliation bill, which, if it goes through, will inflict enormous damage to the economy because of massive tax increases, big regulatory takeover by the government in the name of the Green New Deal, more entitlements, more transfer payments, no work requirements, no employment incentives. I mean, that's going to be a turning point, but we won't have that vote on reconciliation probably for quite some time. So for now, sit back and enjoy it. You know, the market corrected a little bit this week. It's a good time to buy the dip.
I know that you're very much concerned about the government pushing the green crisis.
Which I can't find. What is the green crisis? I love this. That was in the summary notes from the White House description of this infrastructure deal. They call it the climate crisis. Do you know that we're beating the Paris Climate Accord targets, that since 2005, carbon emissions in the U.S. have dropped 25%.
Wow.
Now, the Paris Accords said, using 2005 as a base, that carbon emissions, the target, should drop by 25% by 2025. We got there in 2020. No other country is even close to us. So I'm searching for this climate crisis. I'm looking everywhere. I'm looking outside. I'm looking inside. I'm looking in my top drawer. I cannot find the climate crisis. We have, using fracking and horizontal drilling, with the revolution of natural gas, bringing down costs, bringing down carbon emissions. It's a terrific story, and I wish they wouldn't mess with it. Now they're going to mess with it, and if that happens, the consequences may be quite dire. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it later in the year. But I'm just saying, it's, you know, all these subsidies. There's a lot of green money in this infrastructure bill. Okay, probably not quite half of the bill is green. And if you include mass transit subsidies, that clinches it. But you know what that does? That makes all power and electricity very expensive. And they have to do that because wind and solar is expensive, particularly wind. So you want to go renewable, whether it's the electricity grid, whether it's buses or automobiles, you're making them very expensive by pushing down carbon content. And that's going to hurt middle-income Americans, and it's going to hurt lower-income Americans. You know, the Trump policies gave us cheap and plentiful energy, and the biggest beneficiaries was the blue-collar middle class and the lower-income classes. And Biden's, this so-called climate crisis, which I can't find, will raise all these costs and really do a lot of damage to the very people who can least afford it.
I'm disappointed in President Biden's first 7 months, 6.5 months in office, and it's hurting the country. And if Trump would have approved that pipeline from Russia to Germany, they would have hung him for treason, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I was with President Trump last night. We had a terrific dinner of some of the senior people. And that subject came up. You know, the Bidens are giving Russia the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, but they're taking away from the U.S. the XL Keystone pipeline, and they are preventing drilling in Anwar, both of which approved during the Trump years and reversed during Biden. And I'm telling you, John, gasoline is at least a buck too high because of this.
They're hurting America. They're hurting the poor. They're hurting the middle class by causing price of gasoline to go from $2 to $3.50. And Larry Kudlow, we got to take a break. Thank you and have a great weekend.
Keep your chin up, though. We'll work through it. It's going to be okay.
God bless.
Exploring the truth, telling both sides with common sense thinking. Here's John Katsimatidis on Talk Radio 77 WABC. This is the Cats Roundtable.
Good morning, America. This is the Cats Roundtable. John Katsimatidis here Sunday morning. The virus. It's in every newspaper, every television station. What's going on with us today is Dr. Peter Michalos, our in-house specialist in medicine, and we'll ask him about it. Dr. Peter, how are you?
Good morning, John, and good morning, Cats Roundtable audience. Great to be with you guys on a Sunday morning. So much happening so quickly, so much changing. And basically, I think we're, it's sort of like we finished one pandemic of the original virus that hit the United States, and now we're dealing with this second Delta variant that decimated India and caused so much damage there. But this virus is different, even in the way it presents. We're seeing less loss of smell and less coughing, and people are presenting with high fevers, pounding headaches, and nasal congestion. So it is even presenting differently. And people are concerned because we're seeing breakthrough cases in the vaccinated. The good news is, again, it's not good news if anybody dies, but the good news is that 97% of the people who died were unvaccinated versus those who are vaccinated. So that gives people incentive, I hope. And I've seen some anti-vaxxers in the last week getting vaccinated. For example, in Texas, of the 9,000 COVID deaths since February till now, all but 43 were unvaccinated people. So you're talking about, 4.5% of the people who died. So that's what's going on. That the vaccine does give you protection.
How many Americans? We have 330 million Americans. How many of the 330, 340 million Americans have been vaccinated? Estimation
63 million. No, I know. I have the CDC numbers that I just looked up. As of July 26th, 163 million people in the United States are fully vaccinated. That doesn't include some of them who are partially vaccinated.
And does it include? Does 163 million include the people that had the virus and got over it? They have the antibodies.
Yeah, that includes everybody. Yeah, some people already have antibodies. And, everybody's different. And then the other thing that, we've touched on WABC nobody talks about is that if you're a 100-pound woman and you get the same dose of vaccine versus a 250-pound man, it affects you differently. And the immune response and the level of antibodies you're going to get. So one of the things we're going to see in the future is customizing. So some of the women, for example, who got the two shots got a lot sicker. In the future, I think they're going to customize doses based on weight, just like you take other medicines or antibiotic based on size and weight. So I think that's coming in the future. But 163 million people are fully vaccinated, and the CDC reported in a document I saw today that there were 1,263 people that were that passed away that were fully vaccinated, and of those people,
how many?
1,263
out of 163 million.
Yeah,
would those people have died anyway?
Well, no, those are people who were vaccinated who were reported as dying as COVID from COVID and asymptomatic infections. They said there were 1,200 and hospitalizations 6,239 people. And the people who were aged over 65 who had been vaccinated and got sick, there were 4,868. So that was 74% of people. And 48% of them were female. So that's the current data. But, they also make it clear that the number of COVID-19 vaccine breakthrough infections are an undercount because fully vaccinated persons, the national surveillance relies on passive and voluntary reporting by doctors and hospitals, and the data is not complete or updated or completely representative, but it just gives us a snapshot to help us identify patterns that are happening with breakthrough cases. But the bottom line is, get vaccinated, because this thing is, the Delta variant represents 83% nationally of cases that they're seeing now of COVID, and it's 60% more contagious. But again, thank God we're not seeing as many deaths and hospitalizations, and in a strange way, the fact that it's so contagious is going to bring us to herd immunity faster, because so many more people are going to get infected. Many people are going to get asymptomatic infections, and many people aren't going to just get tested. So I'm hoping that this will drive us home to herd immunity faster, until we can get also the oral antiviral pills that are around the corner. As you heard, Pfizer announced their oral antiviral pill. Merck has their oral antiviral pill. Innovative Pharmaceuticals has their oral antiviral pill.
Why are they saying that they want us to start wearing masks in restaurants again, and masks in all over the place? If 163 million people vaccinated, only 1,000 of them died, 1,200.
Well, we just said 6,000 something hospitalizations. I think they want to do it because they don't want the hospitals to be filling up again with COVID patients and filling up the ICUs. I think that's really part of it. And also, they still don't want people to get sick, because a lot of those people, a certain percentage, maybe 10%, are going to end up with these long COVID symptoms. And you saw the Department of Justice just put out a paper saying that now it's one of the criteria to file for disability, this brain fog, exhaustion, fatigue, breathing problems, panic attacks that people are getting, and nobody fully understands why. And it's going to cost our society billions of dollars in the next few years. So that's another reason why they just don't want as many people to get sick. So for medical, legal, and for risk management, they're telling people to, be more careful. Because what happened? As soon as we took our masks off, we stopped socially distancing, we went out, the cases start to go up. The same thing happened in India. They started having festivals, and everybody gathered down by the rivers for holidays. And then all of a sudden, the cases started going out of control.
Doctor, thank you for coming on. We're out of time, and we're going to – I know we talk to you almost every other day now, and thank you for what you do. And it's Dr. Dr. Peter at WABCRadio.com. Thank you for everything you do, and God bless you, and God bless America.
Thanks for always getting the truth out on the Cats Roundtable.
We have Bill O'Reilly, a journalist, author, television, radio host, prolific author of The Killing series. What, 19, almost 19 million books sold right now? Killing the Mob is killing it.
Well, there's so many things happening, Bill. I understand that you're very concerned about this COVID.
Yeah, I wrote a column today. I usually file my column on Sunday, but because the panic is setting in, so we put it on BillO'Reilly.com. Anybody can go there and read the entire column. But basically, the gist of it is that we need leadership now with the COVID panic, and we're not getting it because Joe Biden is incapable of providing leadership on any issue. And here's the irony of the column after you read it. COVID destroyed Donald Trump. He would have been reelected if that pandemic had not hit because of the economy. Now, COVID, I think, is going to bring down Joe Biden. I think the way he's handling this new Delta variant is creating problems rather than solving them. As president of the United States, Joe Biden's job is to solve problems. And I ask my liberal friends, tell me one problem that the man has solved. The only thing he had going for him was the rollout of the vaccine, which was fairly smooth since he came into office. But now there's a hardcore group of Americans that will not accept the vaccine, and that's causing problems, and Biden doesn't know how to deal with it. The big problem is there isn't one credible source coming out of the medical community. Fauci's finished. Fauci killed himself by trying to play both sides against the middle and deceiving people about the American investment in the Wuhan lab. Now, everybody knows that Fauci's not an upfront guy. He's done. There's nobody else. There's no one else who can speak with authority on behalf of the medical community. Biden is running. As I said, why wouldn't you have a press conference on an issue as important and personal as this? I don't think there's any reasonable person, and the word reasonable here is in capital letters, that feels that the vaccine that was developed under the Trump administration is ineffective. It's effective. It protects you. But you've got groups in America on the far right, African-Americans, that don't trust the government. So they're not going to take the vax. They're afraid. It's fear. What Biden's job is to persuade these people, not threaten them. Persuade them that if you do this, you're doing a good thing for your country, for your family, and for yourself. You're going to have a segment that's not going to cooperate. And those people are not going to be able to live a normal life. They're not, because you're going to start to see the restaurants and the movie theaters and the plays and the sports arenas. They're going to start to ask for that vax card. And if you don't have it, you're going to be denied entry. And that is not unconstitutional. That is perfectly legal.
The New York Times today advocated that non-citizens should be allowed to vote.
The editorial board and the op-ed editors of this newspaper and the Washington Post and the Boston Globe and the LA Times, okay, all want quasi-socialism in America. When I say quasi, that means Sweden socialism, Netherlands socialism. That's what they want. They want single-payer health insurance. They want income redistribution down the line. The only way you get that is to flood the zone with foreign nationals. You don't get it with the traditional American voter. Where do you see what happens next year in the midterms? These people are going to get blown out like it's going to be almost a record unless something happens in the next 15 months. But if the election were held tomorrow, Monday, whatever, the progressive left would get smashed. Because people are going, you know, I don't like these people. I don't want the woke culture. No problems are being solved. I got dead people in the streets every single day, and nothing's being done about it. The solution is put a social worker in the back of a cop car. That's their solution.
Bill O'Reilly, thank you so much for calling in and keeping all the American people informed. And God bless you and God bless America.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening to the Cats Roundtable. Every Sunday morning, we'll bring you the latest in what's happening in our community, our country, and the world. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Have a nice Sunday.